government is at the telegraph apparatus. In view of the enemy's proximity to Yekaterinburg and the exposure by the Cheka of a serious White Guard plot with the goal of abducting the former Tsar and his family, for this reason, in light of the approach of the counter-revolutionary bands toward the Red Capital of the Urals, and the possibility of the crowned executioner escaping trial by the people, a plot among White Guards to try and abduct him and his family was exposed, and the compromising documents have been found and will be published, the Presidium of the Ural Regional Soviet, fulfilling the will of the revolution, resolved to shoot the former Tsar, Nikolai Romanov, who is guilty of countless bloody, violent acts against the Russian people. We ask for your sanction. The documents concerning the plot are being expedited by courier to the Sovnarkom and the Tsik. We are waiting by the apparatus for advice. We urgently request an answer. We are waiting by the apparatus. Facts cannot lie, and in them I see that the stupidity of a young boy hastened the murder of the imperial family of Mother Russia and their four loyal attendants, 11 people in total. But my guilt is even greater, for the Romanovs were more than simply people. Nikolai, Alexandra, and their five children were the ultimate symbols, both good and bad, of all that was Russia, and their brutal murders unleashed such chaos and darkness. Yes, regicide opened the door to fratricide, matricide, and patricide of unimaginable proportion. Some 20, 30, 40 million souls perished under the Reds, helped along in part by me, Lonka Sednyov, the kitchen boy. For if the plot to save the Tsar had succeeded, what corner might history have turned? Might Nikolai have rallied his troops in the depths of Siberia and gone on to defeat the Bolsheviki? Would that gentle, misdirected Tsar have finally found the good direction he had searched for all along, and would he then have been able to lead his people and country back to sanity? I burn with the thoughts of what needn't have been and what might have been. And yet, in a corner of my tired heart, I still believe in the Russian people, that given the light, the life, and the opportunity, a great future awaits them. Meanwhile, of course, Yurovsky and the others were greatly dedicated to the destruction of the bourgeoisie and the creation of a workers' paradise. And yet, while they were most eager to murder the family to cement their cause, there was great hesitation on their part to take any definitive action. After all, Yurovsky, unlike many of those beneath him, was a professional revolutionary, and orders had to be issued and obeyed. The chain of command had to be followed. Consequently, many urgent communications were sent to the Red Tsars in Moscow. To Moscow, Kremlin. To Sverdlov, copy to Lenin. The following has been transmitted over the direct line from Yekaterinburg. Let Moscow know that for military reasons the trial agreed upon cannot be put off. We cannot wait. If your opinions differ, then immediately notify without delay. Trial was the code word for murder, and the confirmation thereof did not come from Moscow until midnight, which was why the family was not led down those 23 steps until after 1 in the morning, on July 17th. In the meanwhile, Yurovsky went about preparing and arranging it all, getting everything ready. He chose a room in the cellar with no exit, a barred window, and soft plaster walls that might prevent ricochets. He ordered a truck ready to transport the bodies, just in case any guards of the outside detachment might disagree with the executions. He had their commander, Pavel Medvedev, confiscate their Nagant revolvers, some 12 in total. So confident was Yurovsky of Moscow's approval that he even told Medvedev, "Tonight we will shoot them. Alert the detachment so they won't be alarmed if they hear shooting." In my books, I have since learned that earlier that afternoon, Yurovsky and the murderers, all of whom were volunteers, not only agreed upon who was to shoot whom, but decided in an almost kind way that they should aim for the hearts so the victims wouldn't suffer. My fate was also decided then. Yurovsky and his Red comrades had no way of knowing that it was I who had been the secret courier all along. They had not an inkling that it was I who had hidden the note in the WC. Had they even suspected, I would surely have been killed as well. Instead, they misperceived me as an innocent, and decided there was no need to kill me, a mere boy, simply because of my association with the royals. Hence, my fate was cast. I was saved, assigned instead to this long life of memory. Some have written that it was the morning of the 16th that I was taken away, others the afternoon, but no, it was that evening just after dinner. Of course it was after dinner. I was washing the dishes in the kitchen when in came the guard, the young one with the blonde beard, who was one of the few who'd survived the recent change in commandante. The commandant requires you. I all but panicked. What? Follow me. Boshe, my God. My first thought was the note, that I had been found out, and I all but dropped the dish in the metal tub. Too scared to say anything, I turned to cook Kharitonov, who stood stirring tomorrow's soup on the oil stove. He stared at me, wiped his hands on his apron. Well, go on, boy. Demidova, the maid, came in just then, a stack of soiled plates in hand, and seeing the odd scene, asked, "Has something happened?" "Leonka has been summoned by the commandant," explained Kharitonov with a shrug. I pulled my hands from the dishwater and dried them on a towel. Was I to be interrogated? I was so afraid, so scared, but said nothing. "Come," ordered the guard. Trembling, I looked at Kharitonov and Demidova, yet knew I had no choice but to go, not realizing that my fate, life, would be worse than anything I could yet imagine. And so I left the imperial family without the slightest farewell, which in turn has left my entire life incomplete. I followed the guards from the kitchen, through the back hall, and out another door into the front of the house. He led me right into the commandant's room, where Yurovsky himself sat at the table drinking his evening tea. I expected to be given quite a dressing down, but instead, Yurovsky spoke quite calmly and evenly, not a trace of suspicion in that unpleasant voice of his. "You are being removed from this house, young man. You are to follow this guard outside and through the gates. He will escort you to the Popov house, where you are to remain until further notified. Is that clear?" This was the last thing I had expected, and I struggled to understand, struggled to make sense of this, and asked, But why?" "You are to wait for your uncle, who will come for you. He will then escort you back to your hometown." Although I had no idea at the time, this was a lie, a very clean lie, and I said, But, Comrade Commandant, what about—" "Your services are no longer required." "What about my things?" I asked, though I had but few possessions. "One of the guards will bring them to you." May I say goodbye to the family and others?" Yurovsky slurped at his tea. "Yet." And then to the guard he imperiously ordered, "Take the boy away." I was thus herded out of the house of special purpose, too scared, too confused to question or protest. What did this mean? That Yurovsky hadn't found the note after all? That I wasn't suspect? That I was really dismissed and was being sent home to Tula province? I knew the times, how difficult and hateful they were, so I kept my mouth shut as I was escorted out of the house, down the outside steps and through the double palisade. But, oh, how I wish I could have said goodbye, at least that. Yet there was no way. Even then I understood. I was helpless, powerless, and as I followed the guard along the edge of Ascension Square and down the little lane to the Popov house, I realized that protest was as useless as... as trying to strip a naked man. So I had no choice. I left. I was taken to the Popov house, where all the outside guards were billeted, shown a cot in a side room, and ordered not to leave. Years later, when all the books started coming out and the archives were opened, I learned how much my disappearance disturbed the family. Even Yurovsky commented on this, later writing, "The boy was taken away, which very much upset the Romanovs and their people." So they were fond of me, more than I could have ever imagined. Apparently, they thought of me as one of their own, and Alexandra herself was so concerned when I was taken away that she sent Dr. Botkin to speak with Yurovsky, who in turn recorded this conversation as well. "But what about the boy?" asked the good doctor. "Where is he? When is he coming back? His father is at the front, and Nikolai Alexandrovich and his wife feel very responsible for him." "You have nothing to worry about," replied Yurovsky, calming him down with another of his easy lies. "Lonka is visiting his uncle Vanya." By then, of course, Uncle Vanya was already long dead, killed Bolshevik style, that is, shot in the back of the head like a mad dog and dumped in a ditch. Later, while her parents were playing cards, Grand Duchess Maria apparently went to the commandant as well, pleading, "Can you tell us, sir, if Lyonka will be returning yet tonight?"
"He will not."
"Then, tomorrow morning, perhaps?"
"Perhaps."
I sat terrified in my new quarters until one of the guards brought me my few things, whereupon I finally lay down. I curled up, using my jacket as a blanket, but of course I couldn't close my eyes, couldn't succumb to the lingering twilight of the Siberian night. And while the billeted guards were laughing and drinking in the other room of the Popov house, I crawled out of bed and went to the window. Across the alley and up the slight hill, the house of special purpose, massive and white, sat entirely dark save for one window. It was the front room, that of the Emperor and Empress, and the limed panes glowed like a moon behind a slight veil of clouds. It was in that room, and about at that time, that Alexandra Fyodorovna sat at the small writing desk, recording her simple, lost words in her diary. "Ekaterinburg, 16 July. Irina's 23rd BD. 11 degrees centigrade. Tuesday. Gray morning. Later, lovely sunshine. Baby has a slight cold. All went out 1/2 hour in the morning. Olga and I arranged our medicines. 3 o'clock. Tatiana read Speer. Readings. 3. They went out. Tatiana stayed with me, and we read. Book of the Prophet Amos and Prophet Obadiah. Tatted. Every morning the commandant comes to our rooms. At last, after a week, brought eggs again for baby. 8 o'clock. Supper. Suddenly, Lyonka Sednyov was fetched to go and see his uncle, and flew off. Wonder whether it's true, and we shall see the boy back again. Played bezique with Nikki. 10:30, to bed. 15 degrees. Not quite 2 hours later, the sound of a simple electric bell signaled the beginning of the end. Even though I had been removed from the House of Special Purpose, I have read so many eyewitness accounts and studied so many documents that in my mind's eye I can picture it all as if it were a movie. We know, for example, that by 11 o'clock Nikolai was asleep, having escaped into the depth of darkness, for sleep was his only refuge from depression. And I am certain that Alexandra, who had been sleeping so poorly, was tossing and turning next to him, madly listening for that midnight whistle that was never to be heard. Otherwise, we know that the only other prisoner who was awake was Dr. Botkin, who sat at the large desk off the living room, writing a prophetic letter to some friend, a certain Sasha. Botkin never finished the letter, of course. It languishes in the Moscow archives, exactly where the doctor broke off. My dear good friend Sasha, I am making a last attempt at writing a real letter, at least from here, although that qualification, I believe, is utterly superfluous. I do not think that I was fated at any time to write anyone from anywhere. My voluntary confinement here is restricted less by time than by my earthly existence. In essence, I am dead. Dead for my children, for my work. I am dead but not yet buried, or buried alive, whichever. The consequences are nearly identical. My children may hold out hope that we will see each other again in this life, but I personally do not indulge in that hope, and I look the unadulterated reality right in the eye. The day before yesterday, as I was peacefully reading Saltykov-Shchedrin, whom I greatly enjoy, I suddenly saw a vision of my son Yuri's face. Yuri, who died in battle in 1914. He was dead, lying in a horizontal position, his eyes closed. Then yesterday, again while reading, I suddenly heard a word that sounded like Papula, dear Papa, and I nearly burst into sobs. Again, this is not a hallucination because the word was pronounced, the voice was identical, and I did not doubt for an instant that my daughter Tatiana, who was supposed to be in Tobolsk, was talking to me. I will probably never hear that voice so dear, or feel that touch so dear, with which my little children have so spoiled me. If faith without works is dead, then deeds can live without faith. This vindicates my last decision. When I unhesitatingly orphaned my own children to carry out my physician's duty to the end, as Abraham did not hesitate at God's demand to sacrifice his only son, hard and shrill, the electric bell rang with a chill just then, shattering the peace of that midsummer's night and interrupting Botkin mid-sentence. He immediately put down his pen, without the slightest thought that he would never pick it up again. Instead, he focused on the bell, understanding that something was quite wrong, for that was the alarm that roused them for morning inspection. Yet here it was now approaching one at night. Concerned, Botkin slid back his chair and stood. He adjusted his gold wire-rimmed spectacles and pulled at his leather suspenders. He could hear noises from beyond, noises from the room of the guards, and he glanced into the living room, where the manservant, Trapp, had been roused from his sleep and was now propped up on his elbows.
"What's happening?" asked Trapp, his eyes puffy with sleep.
Botkin shrugged and ran one hand over his round, balding head.
"Bog znает. Only God knows."
The door leading from the front halls rattled and opened, and Yurovsky emerged into the living room. Botkin stepped forward and asked, "What's the matter?" The commandant calmly replied, "The town is uneasy tonight, and it's too dangerous for all of you to remain upstairs. Would you kindly wake up Citizen Romanov and his family, and ask them to dress as quickly as possible? For safety reasons, all of you will be moved downstairs. This will only be for a short period, so instruct them not to bring anything at all along."
"Yasna." "Understood."
As if he were inviting friends to the dinner table, Yurovsky's summons to mass murder was that easy, that simple. When the commandant disappeared, Botkin turned to Trapp, and the two men silently stared at each other, both of them wondering what this really meant. Finally, Botkin took a deep breath, screwed up his eyes, and said,
"I'll go wake them."
Wearing just an undershirt and his suspenders and pants, he crossed into the dining room, where he turned the switch for the electric chandelier. No sooner had the lights burst on than Nikolai appeared in the doorway on the opposite side of the room.
"What is it?" asked Nikolai, wearing his nightshirt. "We heard the bells."
"By orders of Commandant Yurovsky, we are to dress and move downstairs. He says it's for our own safety. Apparently there is some sort of unrest in town."
"Unrest? What kind of unrest?"
"This I cannot say, Nikolai Alexandrovich. He simply told me to wake you and the others, and that we are to dress as quickly as possible and move to the cellar. He also said this will only be for a short while, and that we are not to bring anything."
Nikolai hesitated in thought before beckoning Botkin forward. "What do you think? Could this be it? Could our friends be on the way?"
"Quite possibly, but it's difficult to say."
"Have you heard anything? Shots? Horses? Anything at all?
Nichts.
Neither have we. Brushing his moustache with the back of his right hand, Nikolai stood in nervous thought. Still, we must be prepared. After all, we can hear the fighting getting closer and closer. The town is sure to fall any day now.
We can only hope.
Wake the others and tell them to be calm, but ready for anything,
ordered the Tsar.
Trap is already up. I'll wake Demidova and Kharitonov. Botkin moved toward the other rooms off the dining room, where the Tsaritsa's maid and cook slept. The Tsar, meanwhile, retreated to the room of his daughters, where all four of them sat up in their cots, the colored glass chandelier now ablaze overhead. Alexandra, wearing a white linen nightgown, stood in the doorway of her bedroom, and even Alexei stood there, balanced on one foot and leaning against the door jamb.
What is it, Nikki? Asked Alexandra, her brow wrinkled with anxiety.
Commandant Yurovsky has ordered us to get dressed and move downstairs. Apparently there's some sort of unrest in town.
Alexandra audibly gasped and pressed a hand to her chest. What do you think? Could it—
I don't know the full story, but he says it's for our own safety. He claims it's to be only for a short while and that we're not to bring anything with us.
Oh, Nikki, God has heard our prayers and they're coming. I just know it. They're coming for us.
At this, the girls began to move about and mumble with excitement, the vision of 300 officers on horseback looming in their virginal minds. Nikolai, however, understood that the situation, whatever it was most precarious, and he turned and checked the dining room. No one was there.
We can't let on to a thing, he commanded his small tribe. We can't let them know our hopes. We just have to be alert and ready for any situation. And we all have to look out for one another, understood?
Ta, papa,
softly replied the children in near unison.
The girls should wear everything, shouldn't they, Nikki? Pressed Alexandra.
He thought for a moment, then answered, everything. Of course, they all knew what that meant. If the family was about to be rescued, they had to carry with them not funds for the Tsar to restore himself to power, but means for them to live. So the girls knew they should wear their diamond-packed corsets, which were not only awkward and uncomfortable, but difficult to put on and lace up. It would take quite some time. Meanwhile, at the other end of the house, Yurovsky paced about, complaining,
These Romanovs, they bathe so much, they read so much, they ask so many questions, and it takes them so long just to get dressed.
Of course it did. The girls had never worn the corsets before, and they were having trouble not only getting them on, but making them as inconspicuous as possible beneath their clothing.
Do as well as you can, girls,
instructed Alexandra, her voice hushed, as she helped her daughters.
We can't let any of the guards suspect. And don't forget, we may have to move quickly.
Of similar heft was Alexandra's corset. But that was not all she wore. Niet, niet, niet. When it came to the Empress of Russia, she also wore a plate of fine gold weighing more than 2 pounds that was bent like a bracelet.
Here, my love, let me help, said Nikolai,
as he slipped the plate up her thin arm, then pulled down the long sleeve of her dress.
Does it show?
She whispered.
Not at all.
Around the Empress's waist, Demidova then fastened the large belt into which Alexandra herself had stitched her ropes of beloved pearls, some the size of a robin's egg.
Is that comfortable, madame?
Asked the maid.
Just fine.
Turning to her husband and son, Alexandra said, Don't forget your hats.
Of course not, replied the Tsar.
Adjusting his own cap, Alexei grinned, thrilled with the charade.
How do I look, papa?
Perfect, like a brave soldier.
Father and son wore their simple army clothes, coarse wool pants, field shirts, worn boots, and of course their forage caps, into which had been sewn those diamonds, rubies, emeralds, and sapphires that were too big for the girls' corsets. The remaining oversized gems, including a 70-carat diamond and 90-carat emerald, Alexandra and her daughters had stitched into 3 traveling pillows, 2 of which she distributed to her daughters, 1 to Demidova.
If they ask about the pillows, instructed the Empress, tell them these are simply for our comfort while we wait.
When he saw his wife reach for her favorite icon, Nikolai said, Sonny, my treasure, we're not to bring anything.
But what about St. Fyodor's? I can't possibly go anywhere without it.
Trust me, if fortune shines upon us and we leave this very night, I'll send someone back for it. She hesitated, then replied, Certainly, my love, you always know what's best.
Papa, what about Jimmy?
Begged Anastasia of her tiny King Charlie.
Joy's outside and can take care of himself, but we can't leave Jimmy behind. If we do, one of the guards will step on him, I just know it.
All right, but carry him snugly in your arms. As if he were bestowing Easter blessings upon them all, the Tsar went from child to child, kissing them each. He ended with his wife, taking her into his arms, holding her tightly and kissing her softly. Were their prayers about to be answered? Was their rescue at hand? We're all together, which is the most important thing. Everything's going to be all right, he assured her and the others. Whatever happens, just remain calm. God will watch over us.
As will our friend, said Alexandra, referring to her Rasputin.
With the Tsar pushing his son in the wheeling chaise, the imperial family emerged from their bedchambers. It had taken them nearly an hour to get ready. It was nearly 2 in the morning. Full of excitement, full of hope, the Domanovs now proceeded into the drawing room, where Botkin, Trap, Demidova, and Kharitonov were eagerly waiting. This time the Tsar addressed everyone, saying, Our fate is in God's hands, in whom we place all trust. Nikolai gave Botkin the nod, and the doctor went to the outer door and called out that they were ready. The door immediately opened, and Yurovsky, appearing infinitely serene, beckoned them forward.
Follow me. We'll proceed down the rear stairs and into one of the cellar rooms.
Somewhat earlier, perhaps about the time that the electric bells were sounded, I myself had climbed from my bed, for sleep could not possess me. I was much too afraid. Even though Yurovsky had said I was to join my Uncle Vanya, there had been no sign of him, and I wanted to go back to them, the Romanovs, the only family I had in these parts. So, when I saw that the 4 other guards in my room of the Popov house had drunk themselves into deep sleep, I got up. I slipped on my jacket and carefully, quietly went outside. The rains of the previous days had stopped, and the night sky was clear and dark. I didn't know what or where I intended to do or go, but when I looked across the alley, I could see the house blazing with electric light. Of course, I knew which rooms were which, and I immediately saw the painted windows of the family's rooms glowing brighter than ever. I instantly understood that they had been roused for some reason, and my first thought was that the officers had indeed come to their rescue. Gospody, dear Lord! What joy! What happiness! I rushed up the alley, my happiness tempered only by the worry that I might be left behind. Or was I all wrong? Scurrying up the muddy alley toward the square, I suddenly saw a guard at the corner of the tall palisade. Recognizing him as part of the regular Red Guard, I dipped behind the tree and into a cloak of darkness. A moment later, the guard disappeared, and I scurried forward. It was in such secret fashion that I made it all the way up the alley and eventually onto the square. I hid behind the small Orthodox shrine, and while I could see the windows all glowing with light, I could discern nothing odd. There were no officers on horseback, no Cossacks whooping and hollering. Looking up at the roof, I could see a lone guard behind a machine gun. Everything appeared completely normal, which in turn led me to believe that if the rescue attempt hadn't already taken place, it was about to be launched. Which is when I heard it. Not much at first, but it was a sound that grew by the moment. No, this was not the sound of 300 officers on horseback galloping to the rescue of Batushka, the dear father. It was the sound of a motor. At first, I wondered if it was an airplane, but then I realized it was in fact an automobile or motor lorry. In itself a rarity in Yekaterinburg, particularly at that time of night. Finally, I saw it. A single, bulky motor lorry emerging from one of the side streets and heading right across the square toward the house. In the dim northern light, I recognized that the back of it was covered with a canvas roof. Could there be soldiers back there? 12 sharpshooters? As the vehicle approached, I hunkered down behind the shrine and saw that it was a Fiat.
and as it passed, I realized the rear of the truck was empty. Unable to suppress my curiosity, I chased after the lorry as it drove directly up to the house. When the vehicle stopped at the large wooden gates, the driver leaned out and called, "Trubashist," chimney sweep. With this code word, the gates were thrown open, and as the lorry rumbled forward, I scurried along the far side of it, following it down the short hill and around the back of the house. When the clumsy vehicle pulled to a stop, I scurried off, taking shelter alongside one of the sheds. Crouched in the darkness, I watched as several guards approached the Fiat truck. Words were spoken so deep and cluttered that I could not understand a thing, and then all was silent. I saw several other guards move about, but little else. 20 minutes passed, perhaps more, and I wondered what in the name of the devil I should do. I was stuck in my hiding place, too terrified to move for fear of being caught, for wouldn't they shoot me if they found me? I finally heard movement from within the house, the sound of many feet on wooden steps, and I pushed myself as deep as I could into the shadows of the small shed. That was a group of people descending those 23 steps, the 23 wooden steps that led from the main floor down the back of the house and to the scruffy garden. We had descended that staircase so many times, once in the morning and once again in the afternoon, and always gladly, for that was the route to fresh air and the walk outside. But not that night. Frightened, my eyes scanned the courtyard that was filled with a couple of wooden sheds and the big silent truck. I heard them before I saw them, all the men with their boots and the women with their heels clattering. Finally, a side door was pushed open. First came Yurovsky. Then came the Tsar, wearing, of course, those worn dark brown leather boots of his. They'd obviously left the wheeling chaise upstairs, and in his arms Nikolai Alexandrovich effortlessly carried his beloved son and my friend, Alexei. Both of them, father and son, were dressed alike in simple army hats and clothing. Next came Alexandra Fyodorovna, wearing a long dark skirt and long-sleeved light blouse, her long thick hair put up on her head. She looked so old that night, so tired. Yet in the shadows of that night, I thought I saw a glimmer of hope smooth her brow as she glanced around, perhaps looking for someone or something. Next came the girls, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia, all of them dressed in identical dark skirts and light blouses, all of them with nothing on their heads and, of course, no wraps on their shoulders. Rather than appearing exhausted, they seemed lively and eager. I saw that both Tatiana and Maria carried small pillows, and that Anastasia cradled her treasured dog, Jimmy, who was so ominously quiet. Following them came Dr. Botkin, Demidova, who also clutched a pillow, Valet Trapp, and Cook Haritonov. No one spoke. No one protested or sobbed. What did they think? What had they been told? From my hiding place, I watched as the line of Romanovs and the last of their faithful calmly and quietly followed Yurovsky along the back of the house. Alexandra, who suffered on and off from sciatica, limped slightly, but she kept up, certainly spurred on by her ever-present faith. They were midway toward the other end of the house when I saw my favorite, Maria Nikolaevna, gazing up at the sky. I turned my attention upward as well, peering through the leaves at the dark heavens above, whereupon my eyes landed on a handful of stars. When my attention fell back to earth, I saw that Maria was no longer staring at the heavens, but gazing directly at me. She saw me there in the bushes, and for an instant that I can never forget, our eyes embraced. Recognizing me, but not daring to betray my presence, Maria Nikolaevna even cast me a small smile.
"This way," called Yurovsky, leading them into the far door.
Thus the group of 11 calmly disappeared into that mouth of death, proceeding back into the cellar and to a rear chamber from which there would be no escape. Losing sight of them, I scurried around, darting like a spy from shed to bush to tree to bush, and there, through a large open window covered with a heavy metal grating, I not only saw all of them in that cellar room, but heard them as well. It was not that large of a space, not really,
and held not a stick of furniture. The walls were covered in striped yellow wallpaper, the rear door to the storeroom appeared locked, and a single electric bulb hung from the low ceiling.
"There have been various rumors in the capitalist press as to your safety," began Yudovsky, spinning his lies with such great ease. "Because of this, we would like to take your photograph to reassure people in Moscow. Would you be so kind as to line up against the wall?"
That was all the commandant did. All he needed to say to get his unsuspecting group to line up in a nice, easy firing line. Clearly pleased with himself, Yudovsky turned to beckon his executioners. At that moment, however, Alexandra Fyodorovna, ever herself, clawed out at him.
"What, there isn't even a chair?"
said the Tsaritsa with the last imperious comment of her life.
"One isn't even allowed to sit down?"
Smiling to himself, Yudovsky hesitated but a moment, then left without replying, gently shutting the double doors behind him. I crept along, spied the commandant in the next room, and through the open doorway heard him bark at a soldier.
"Apparently the Empress wishes to die sitting down," he said with a stout laugh. "Fetch me two chairs."
What did Yudovsky mean? What was he up to? Panic crawling up my throat, I moved back and peered through the grated window at the Romanovs. Should I shout out? Scream a warning? One of the two doors was kicked open, and Yudovsky entered, smiling to himself as he delivered two chairs. Taking one of the pillows for supposed comfort, Alexandra Fyodorovna sat in one chair near the window, while the other was positioned to her right for Alexei. The Tsar carefully lowered his son onto this chair, and then the other members of the imperial family, photographed so many thousands of times, automatically assumed positions as though for an official portrait. Behind the Empress, yet more toward the middle of the room, stood the four daughters. Close by their side was Demidova, faithfully clutching her pillow as if it were a treasure, while behind Alexei stood Botkin, Trap, and Horitonov. The Tsar himself stood between mother and son. Once again, Yudovsky stepped out of the room, pulling shut the doors behind him. And then came the longest, oddest silence, in which my heart began to beat ever so fast. Inside the chamber, not one of the Romanovs spoke. Alexandra Fyodorovna did turn and gaze out one of the windows, searching, I'm sure, for those officers. About then, Tatyana came over and placed her hand on her mother's shoulder, which Alexandra took and reassuringly kissed. Suddenly, the lorry in the courtyard fired up its engine, its noisy motor roaring in the night. All at once, Yudovsky returned, throwing open the double doors into the small cellar room. He quickly moved in, and 10 henchmen brandishing Nagant revolvers awkwardly piled through the small opening behind him. Except for one, they were all the new guards, the so-called Letts. Crowded to the side as if an afterthought, I recognized one of the former guards, the young one with the blondish beard. Calm and self-assured, the commandant unfolded a piece of paper and boldly proclaimed, "In view of the news that your relatives both inside the country and from abroad have attempted to free you, the Ural Executive Committee has decided to execute you by—" The Tsar cut in, his voice loud and desperate. "Что? Что?" "What? What?" Rather surprised at being interrupted, Yudovsky cleared his throat and started over. "In view of the news that your relatives both inside the country and from abroad have attempted to free you, the Ural Executive Committee has decided to execute you by firing squad." Horrified, Alexandra Fyodorovna threw her right hand up, desperate to make her sign to her god. Olga, the eldest daughter, likewise attempted a plea to a greater mercy. "Papa!" screamed Anastasia, clutching her dog Jimmy against her chest. His voice shaking, Nikolai turned slightly, muttering, "Forgive them, father, they know not what—" 11 people lined up in a small room as though for a photograph. 11 assassins piled into a narrow doorway. The shooting began in nearly the same instant, and Nikolai Kravavi, the bloody, caught the first hail. All at once the blast of those 11 revolvers struck and lifted the Tsar off the ground, hurling him back through the air. his head exploded, showering his daughters with a coarse spray of his blood and brains. An instant later, Alexandra, the Bolsheviki's hated German bitch, took a handful of bullets in the face and mouth, the force of which threw her back as well, her cross-making hand flailing upward, her chair hurling back, her feet flying overhead as she tumbled, ass overhead, into infinity.
"Aim for the heart!"
shouted Yurovsky. A horrible wail of confusion rose in the room. In complete terror, the daughters ran about screaming, begging, and shrieking. Botkin shouted and pleaded. Demidova wailed. Trapp and Kharitonov sobbed. Only poor Alexei, stranded as he was, remained in place, clutching his eyes shut, grabbing at the sides of his chair as bullets whizzed all about him. The gunshots started coming faster, more desperate, but remarkably, no one else fell. I heard the twinging of ricochets, saw sun-like sparks burst as bullets bounced off those corsets so thick with jewels that they had inadvertently been made bulletproof. Protected as they were by all those invincible carrots, the girls were not granted a quick death. Rather, it appeared as if God himself were shielding them, and a great cry arose not from the horrified victims, but their executioners, so sure were they of the divineness of these white princesses. Terrified, the guards started pumping the bullets faster, more desperately. Finally, big Dr. Botkin tumbled, a bear of a man who dropped to his knees and fell face first into death. I saw Olga running to the side, clasping her ears. Suddenly, her neck was ripped wide in a streak of crimson, and she, too, dove into the beyond. Trapp, Kharitonov, they were next, paying in blood for their faithful service. As they fell, a devilish fog began to fill the room and clouded with confusion, for all the modern smokeless bullets had been used up during the war. And then Alexei tumbled from his meager wooden throne.
"Mama! Papa!"
rose the shrieks of those girls. I saw Anastasia bending her head, shielding her Jimmy, shrieking hell and devil. I saw Maria run back and forth, then fall against the wall. And I saw Demidova holding that priceless pillow up like armor. And too, I saw Tatiana's face and neck and arms blister with death. Within moments, the entire room filled with smoke from the bullets. Yet still it went on, the shots slapping and hurling, biting and ripping. I heard the deep voices of the guards coughing and shouting, gagging, and yelling as they stirred up this black stew of pandemonium. And though the guards could no longer see their targets, it went on and on. 11 men firing 11 guns for a minute is a lifetime. Upward of 10 minutes is an eternity. But it took that long and longer to cut down those 11 victims. Eventually, the bullets began to slow, and the smoke began to lift. Several of the men, vomiting and coughing on the acrid smoke, retreated into the hallway. The clouds of death parted, revealing Yurovsky as he walked above the dead. Waving his hand back and forth in front of his face, the commandant peered down through the dimmest of light, at the young heir. It was then that I saw Alexei, still moving, still treading life, still moaning and writhing as he clutched his father by the sleeve. Lowering his gun, Yurovsky placed the barrel on Alexei's temple and blasted, once, twice. He and the guards, who had fetched rifles from the hallway, moved on through the room, discovering that even after all the shooting, three of the sisters and Botkin were still alive, convulsing as they choked on their own blood. Approaching Tatiana, A dark, bearded guard raised his rifle and bayonet over her and plunged at her heart. Despite all his brutal virility, however, the dull blade bounced off her, and the young princess twisted and contorted in semi-conscious pain. Confused and dismayed, the guard straddled her, clutched his rifle in both hands, and plunged again, and again met with no success. Unable to puncture her chest, and clearly terrified by her immortality, the man whipped out a knife and quickly slit her throat, finally finding proof positive in her butchered neck that she was not the daughter of a demigod. Suddenly, a woman's voice screamed out, "Thank God!" It was Demidova. "God has saved me!" I caught sight of the Tsaritsa's maid, who had apparently only fainted, and was now pushing herself from the floor, smeared with the blood of her masters. No sooner had she risen back to life, however, than a herd of men were upon her, and she fell once again and for all, screaming, screaming, screaming so horribly as she grabbed at the dull, rusty bayonets that punctured her full, round body no less than 30 times. For a brief moment, there was silence and peace, which in turn was broken by a pathetic whimper and an animal-like cry. One of the guards went over to Anastasia and plunged her throat with his bayonet. Miraculously, however, the cry grew but louder, until suddenly the girl's tiny pet wiggled and squirmed from beneath the child's carved body. Seeing the little dog, now soaking crimson, try to scramble away, its back legs broken, the guard raised one of his heavy boots and smashed little Jimmy's head. All in all, it took 20 minutes before silence graced the basement chamber of the House of Special Purpose. 18. Hidden in the bushes, I stared off at the black sky, seeing nothing, neither star nor moon, but seeing again that which I had just witnessed, those 20 minutes. Hearing them too. Dada, hearing their screams. Ever since, for 8 decades now, I have daily seen this cinema of horror in my mind's eye, and I watch it from this angle, from that, and nearly go insane. I find myself so angry. Angry at all the tsars of my Russia for driving my homeland down the dead-end path of autocracy. Angry at the Bolsheviki for not realizing that communism is naught but a gorgeous dream that can never be. Angry at Alexandra for being a supreme mother not to her country, but her invalid son. Angry at Nikolai for not signing that one piece of paper that would have averted all. Sure, Russia in its own clumsy, inevitable way was stumbling toward a constitutional monarchy, and because Nikolai could not see this, because he could not sign a simple paper granting a ministry appointed not by him, but by his parliament, he and his family, as well as about 40 million others, were slaughtered. The thick, acrid smoke had yet to clear before the henchmen were upon their victims, red vultures picking at the imperial family as if they were carrion. While Yurovsky was going from body to body, verifying pulses and the sort, two of the guards were in the hall, still vomiting not because of the gore, but because of the foul smoke from those old-fashioned bullets. The rest of the guards forgot every bit of their ideology and searched pockets and wrists and necks for trinkets and treasures. Greed was their strongest urge, and these henchmen fed furiously upon their victims. They wanted more for themselves, and so they feasted upon those they had killed for possessing too much. Only Yurovsky stood as the pillar of the ideal revolutionary, and he flushed with disdain upon seeing the joyful looting.
He shouted, "You are to take nothing. Nothing. Now I want half of you to go upstairs and gather all the sheets you can, and I want the other half to go out to the shed and gather the shafts from the troikas."
When he saw the hesitation among them, Yurovsky raised his gun.
"Go!"
For a long moment, none of the guards left. Realizing he was losing control, Yurovsky took aim at one of the men.
"Leave!"
One by one, the assassins departed. Shaken by the disobedience, Yurovsky stood there, pistol raised, as he guarded his royal kill. And because of this challenge, he never finished verifying the dead, specifically Anastasia, Kharitonov, and Maria. Minutes later, his men returned, and according to Yurovsky's directions, the sheets were suspended between the harnessing shafts, and the bodies loaded up. With the noisy engine of the motor lorry masking the commotion, the Romanovs and their small retinue were then carted out one by one and heaved into the back of the vehicle. The entire time, I sat there, hidden in the darkness, watching, seeing with my own two eyes, and yet not believing. Not a tear did I shed, not even then. Not a whimper did I cry. Somehow fear steeled me, protected me, for had I started crying, I would have been pulled from my hiding place and killed as well. Once the last of the bodies was heaped upon the pile in the back of the truck, the biggest of the guards pulled himself onto the truck. He scrambled over the dead, pawed at them like a mad dog, and laughing, reached into a pile of Romanovs. He threw aside an arm, tugged at a bloody dress, and seized upon a fleshy prize. A moment later, he leaped up and held out his cupped hand as if it were full of gold.
"Now that I have touched the Empress's pussy, I can die in peace,"
he laughed and shrieked. His joy was a call to chaos, and his comrades hooted with fiendish delight. All at once, the lot of them climbed and clambered aboard, once again pulling at boots and necklaces, eyeglasses, and especially watches, which Russians have always sought as a souvenir of death. Though they failed to discover the fortune of diamonds hidden in the royal corsets, the guards clambered over the carcasses of their history, desperately pawing for riches of any kind. Suddenly, Yurovsky charged out of the house, cocked his gun, and shouted, "The next man who takes anything gets a bullet in the head! Drop everything you've taken and get back inside now!" The frenzy came to an immediate but uncomfortable pause, followed by grumbling and some reluctant movement.
"I'll be checking each and every one of you, and should I find that you've taken anything, anything, you'll be executed immediately."
All of a sudden, things began to fall. A bracelet. An amulet. Dr. Botkin's glasses. One of the traveling pillows. The guards dropped them back onto the bodies, and these things landed with soft plops upon the still warm flesh. From where I hid, I sensed the bodies shifting as the guards clambered over them. The next moment, I saw an arm slip out from beneath the canvas top, the gold watch on that arm sparkling in the night. The guards did as they were told. All it took was terror to whip them into control, of course, and this team of executioners leaped to the ground and hurried inside. Thereupon, big buckets of sawdust were carted into the cellar room, brooms, too, and mops. They had to obliterate all signs of the crime. The Whites would take the city any day, and the Reds couldn't leave any trace of the bodies or even the murders. All along, the greatest danger to their cause had not been the possibility of Nikolai being restored to the throne. Neither Red nor White wanted that, but the very real possibility of the Whites seizing the dead Tsar and his family and resurrecting them as martyrs to their cause. But of course, there could be no martyrs if there were no bodies. While all of this cleaning up was going on, I stared at the dead arm swinging back and forth, the gold watch on that arm ticking this way and that against the side of the Fiat lorry. As if mesmerized by Rasputin himself, I was drawn out of the darkness and I inched forward. They say that a Russian cannot believe with his eyes what he cannot touch with his hand. And against my own will, I was drawn forward. Without even thinking, I reached out. I reached out and clutched the arm of Batushka, the dear father. I held on to his muscular arm for but a moment. And then I pulled at his watch. When my hands came away, not only did I clutch something as brilliant as the sun, but my fingers were sticky red with his death. Minutes later, after great confusion, the motor lorry finally made its departure. Once again, I trotted after it, hiding in the vehicle's night shadow as it passed through the gates. Of course, I should have fled, but this never occurred to me. Not once. I should have taken off across the square, but somewhere I understood that the end of the tale had not yet come. And so, like a pathetic dog, I trotted after my dead master as the lorry moved through the dark, muddy streets of Yekaterinburg. Da, 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 like a faithful dog, I chased after that motor truck that was overflowing with all those troopy, those bodies. With a driver, a single guard, and Yurovsky seated up front, the vehicle proceeded so very slowly that I had no trouble keeping up, and when it drove all the way around the far side of the racetrack, I took the shortcut and actually had to wait for it to pass. When it headed northward on the dirt lane to the village Kaptiki, I trotted after it. Usually it was only carts and wagons that moved along here, peasants bringing their fish or game to sell in town. But not tonight. Not tonight. I had no idea of its destination, but I ran after the motor lorry, and the vehicle barely creaked along. Certainly not faster than a cart itself. A few versts from town, one of the wheels sank into a deep hole, then rose quickly out of it, hit a stone, and the whole back of the lorry bounced violently. That very instant, a black heap of something was thrown from the rear of the truck, landing with a near silent thud on the dirt road. At first I couldn't imagine, but then it bolted through me, seized my heart. Gospody, dear Lord, one of the bodies had been hurled from the lorry onto the ground. I froze in horror, then bolted forward, hurried to this sack of death lying so still in the rutted road to Kaptiki. Da, da, it was a body, that much was clear. And not Dr. Botkin, and not one of the ladies. No, it was the heir Tsarevich Alexei Nikolaevich. A rag doll of a body. That was all that was left. He was the mirror of me, this boy was. We were about the same height, the same age, and there he lay, twisted and crumpled, his military tunic torn, his face so... Gospody, dear Lord. When I knelt to him, I saw the side of his head all black and shattered. His right ear was gone, blasted away by the two bullets that Yurovsky had fired point-blank into the side of his head. Da, da, the bullets had pierced the skull, not blowing it apart, really, but surely exploding through his brains and out the other side. But his face, it was... My stomach turned. Slithered like a snake up the back of my throat. I turned away, then immediately looked back. Yes, it was him. There was no doubt, even though it was almost impossible to tell, for they had slashed his face with bayonets, beaten it with rifle butts. Mother of God, this boy who had so yearned to play shakhmati, well... There was nothing left to gaze at but slaughtered meat and bone, hanging, dripping into the earth of Siberia, so mutilated was he. I couldn't move. I stared down at this grossly killed boy, the heir to the throne of Russia, and the blackest of terrors filled my every pore. I wanted to die. I wanted someone to blow my own brains out, to blast this sight from my mind. But then the truck started picking up speed.